en colloque. Une émission de la rédaction de Canal Academy. On retrouve Élodie Courtejoie.
Bonjour, c'est une certitude, depuis le début de l'année 2007, la planète connaît des épisodes climatiques extrêmes. En janvier et avril, les températures de surface sur Terre ont été respectivement plus chaudes de 1,89 et de 1,37 par rapport aux moyennes enregistrées depuis 1880. Aucun continent n'a été épargné par les cataclysmes. En Europe, par exemple, l'Angleterre et le Pays de Galles ont reçu de mai à juillet 2007 la quantité de précipitations la plus élevée depuis 1766. En Asie, à Oman, les habitants ont vu le premier cyclone de leur histoire et puis une vague de chaleur a frappé l'Inde au milieu du mois de mai avec des températures atteignant 45 voire 50 degrés. En Afrique, le Mozambique a été frappé en février 2007 par des inondations provoquant la mort de 30 personnes et l'évacuation de 120 000 autres, alors que parallèlement, on pouvait skier en Afrique du Sud avec les 25 cm de neige fraîchement tombée. Enfin, en Amérique latine, l'ouragan Dean, en août et septembre 2007, a provoqué sur son passage la mort d'une trentaine de personnes dans les Caraïbes et au Mexique. Alors comment se préparer face à ces catastrophes climatiques? Comment limiter leurs dégâts sur notre environnement? Le colloque Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes, organisé par l'Académie des sciences en juillet 2007, s'est penché sur la question. Ce colloque s'inscrit dans un cadre central sur les connaissances acquises ou à acquérir pour préparer les sociétés humaines aux événements climatiques extrêmes. Nous vous proposons d'écouter une grande partie de ces interventions, à la fois en anglais et en français, retransmise au cours de 5 émissions en colloque sur Canal Academy. Dans cette 5e et dernière partie, il s'agit de tirer les leçons du passé pour se prémunir contre les conséquences directes ou indirectes des événements climatiques extrêmes. Vous allez pouvoir entendre dans quelques instants Paul Martin, Serge Planton et Laurent Mermet. Dans cette première partie, Paul Martin de l'Institut Pasteur de Nouvelle-Calédonie revient sur les épidémies et les leçons à tirer du passé pour assurer un dispositif de réponse performant. Quant à Serge Planton, climatologue au Centre National de Recherche Météorologique, il nous détaille les impacts du changement climatique sur les événements climatiques extrêmes. Son intervention est en anglais. Mais tout de suite, Paul Martin.
Alors, épidémie et événements extrêmes, c'est vrai qu'il y a des événements extrêmes qui provoquent des épidémies. Les guerres, par exemple, qui en elles-mêmes impliquent des changements, des bouleversements et des regroupements de populations peuvent provoquer des épidémies. Mais c'est vrai aussi que beaucoup d'événements extrêmes, en particulier le tsunami, par exemple, du 26 décembre, on attendait après ce tsunami, et des gens l'ont dit, qu'il y aurait des épidémies dans l'Asie du Sud-Est, et en fait, il n'y a eu aucune épidémie. Donc, il y a beaucoup d'événements extrêmes, brutaux, qui, en fait, ne provoquent pas d'épidémie. Donc, là encore, on a des données qui sont très parcellaires. Épidémie et climat, puisqu'il s'agissait d'événements extrêmes climatiques, c'est vrai que des variations du climat, elles peuvent influencer le développement d'épidémies. Et on a là un peu plus de documentation. En particulier, les variations climatiques, à l'heure actuelle, sont en train de modifier la répartition mondiale, géographique, de certains grands vecteurs de maladies. Et en particulier aux États-Unis, par exemple, il y a maintenant, chaque année, plus de 20 000 cas de maladie à virus West Nile, alors qu'il n'y en avait pas du tout il y a une quinzaine d'années, et que c'est un nouveau vecteur qui est arrivé, qui a envahi l'ensemble des États-Unis, et le virus a suivi. Des variations climatiques peuvent aussi modifier les migrations animales, et par exemple, entre autres, les migrations d'oiseaux. Et évidemment, si elles modifient les migrations d'oiseaux, elles peuvent modifier la circulation, le voyage, géographiquement en tout cas, des virus de la grippe aviaire en particulier, donc toucher des populations d'oiseaux sauvages ou domestiques ou d'élevage qu'elles n'auraient pas touchées sans cette variation climatique. Et puis il y a donc un risque accru à ce moment-là de voir un réassortant de virus aviaire et virus humain et le démarrage dans une zone inattendue d'une épidémie de type grippe espagnole. Mais ceci, ce sont des variations climatiques lentes, plutôt à long terme, et non pas des événements climatiques extrêmes, on va dire, qui provoquent ces variations. On a un autre exemple aussi assez bien documenté, qui est l'influence du climat sur les épidémies de méningite, dans la ceinture africaine subsaharienne de la méningite. Mais en réfléchissant au problème, je suis aperçu quand même que ce qui était des événements extrêmes, c'était les épidémies elles-mêmes qui sont des événements extrêmes réellement. Et donc, comme il y avait une session sur se préparer aux événements extrêmes, j'ai traité le sujet un petit peu comme cela, en pensant que ça pouvait servir d'exemple dans l'histoire, voir comment les sociétés humaines, les hommes, se sont organisés pour répondre et prendre en charge un événement extrême, les événements extrêmes que sont les épidémies. Donc, pour commencer, qu'est-ce qu'une épidémie de façon simple? C'est un système, c'est une relation assez complexe en fait, un phénomène qui met en relation une population d'hôtes, cible, qui peut être une population humaine ou une population animale ou végétale, une population de micro-organismes pathogènes, et puis un certain nombre de facteurs de l'environnement. Et c'est ce triangle qui est important à toujours avoir en tête lorsque on analyse une épidémie. Donc, il est certain que l'hôte, le micro-organisme pathogène et l'environnement ont chacun leur rôle dans le démarrage et le développement d'une épidémie. Est-ce que les épidémies sont des événements extrêmes? Oui, certainement, pour beaucoup de raisons, mais au moins pour une, parce qu'ils ont un impact dramatique sur les populations qu'ils touchent, et en particulier sur les populations humaines, je me suis limité à l'homme. Plusieurs zones géographiques dans l'histoire ont été réellement décimées par les épidémies. En Europe, les grandes pestes ont fait des millions de morts. Les historiens ne sont jamais vraiment d'accord sur l'impact que ça a eu sur la population. Mais pour vous donner un exemple, en 1720, lorsque la peste est arrivée pour la dernière fois à Marseille, il y avait 100 000 habitants dans la ville de Marseille. Et en quelques semaines, la peste a tué 50 000 habitants. Donc 50% de morts, c'est quand même un impact extrêmement important sur Marseille et sur la Provence ensuite. En Amérique du Sud, c'est certainement le continent qui a le plus souffert dans l'histoire des épidémies. On estime qu'il y avait entre 61 et 63 millions d'habitants au moment de la découverte de l'Amérique du Sud par les Européens. Il y a eu environ 50 millions de morts suite entre l'arrivée des Européens et le début du XXe siècle. Et on estime que 42 à 45 millions de morts ont été dus aux épidémies, en particulier aux épidémies de variole qui ont été extrêmement douloureuses dans ce continent. Donc vous voyez, on a enlevé là 80% de la population est morte à cause des épidémies. Dans le monde polynésien, dans le Pacifique Sud, les chiffres sont plus importants en pourcentage, moins importants bien entendu en nombre absolu, mais c'est comme ça que j'avais commencé à m'intéresser aux épidémies dans le Pacifique Sud en étudiant les pertes de population dans les îles Marquises et puis dans l'ensemble de la Polynésie française au cours des grandes épidémies du XXe siècle, dans un cadre de travail qui était un peu difficile, comme vous pouvez le voir. Et ce qui est intéressant dans ce système, c'est que on a, pour l'ensemble de ces îles, on a des recensements périodiques qui ont été faits, qui sont assez précis, voire très précis. Et puis on a des bateaux dont on connaît le nom, dont on connaît la date de passage, et on connaît la maladie qu'ils ont apportée, qu'ils ont laissée. Donc au moment de la découverte par Cook de Tahiti en 1769, il y avait aux Marquises au moins 50 000 habitants. On connaît l'arrivée de la tuberculose par un bateau français qui venait de Tahiti et qui est arrivé aux Marquises. On connaît même le nom du tuberculeux qui a amené la maladie. Et cette maladie s'est répandue et a fait des ravages extraordinaires dans des îles qui ne connaissaient pas du tout la tuberculose, qui ne l'avaient jamais vue. Et en 1843, il n'y avait plus que 20 000 habitants sur les 50 ou 60 000 du départ. Est arrivée alors une épidémie de typhoïde, puis une épidémie d'influenza, de grippe. Et en 1857, donc vous voyez 15 ans plus tard, il n'y avait plus que 50% enfin 40% des habitants avaient été tués par ces deux épidémies. Arrive alors une épidémie de variole, puis une épidémie de dengue, et en 1881, il n'y a plus que 5700 habitants, et le nombre d'habitants va diminuer pour arriver en 1911 à la guerre à 3000 habitants, alors qu'on avait entre 50 et 60 000 marquisiens un peu plus d'un siècle auparavant. Donc vous voyez le taux de mortalité extraordinaire que ces épidémies ont provoqué. Et c'est seulement à partir de 1918 que petit à petit la population va réaugmenter pour atteindre aujourd'hui un peu moins de 20 000 habitants, c'est-à-dire un peu moins de ce qu'elle avait en 1843. Donc ça, c'est vraiment des événements qui sont absolument terribles pour une population. La même chose est arrivée dans l'ensemble de la Polynésie. On a vraiment une documentation qui est qui est très jolie dans toutes ces îles. Alors pourquoi les épidémies peuvent devenir des événements extrêmes ? Bien pour un certain nombre de causes qui sont dues aux microbes pathogènes, aux populations elles-mêmes ou à l'environnement, dans les trois côtés du triangle dont je vous parlais tout à l'heure. Il y a des microbes qui sont des pathogènes, donc qui sont extrêmement tueurs et qui sont extrêmement épidémiogènes, c'est-à-dire qui ont à la fois la capacité de diffuser dans les populations et qui ont même des gènes, on le connaît pour la peste par exemple, qui ont des gènes qui leur permettent vraiment de mieux diffuser dans la population et qui ont des taux de létalité extrêmement élevés. C'est le cas donc de la peste, c'est le cas aussi de la grippe aviaire, qui est un virus donc très très hautement pathogène, et c'est le cas aussi du virus de la variole. Il y a des causes qui sont dues aux populations cibles, et en particulier dans les îles, et on a un phénomène qui est très important, c'est qu'il y a généralement, ces îles sont vierges par rapport à un certain nombre de virus ou de bactéries, des groupes de virus et de bactéries, et donc il n'y a aucune immunité de cohorte des populations humaines ou animales d'ailleurs, hein. Et donc, lorsque un virus ou une bactérie arrive, elle va se diffuser, elle va être très facilement, il n'y aura aucune barrière immunitaire, si vous voulez, elle va diffuser très facilement dans la population. Il y a aussi des populations qui ont une susceptibilité génétique particulière, c'est le cas d'une population bien particulière, une ethnie bien particulière au Soudan, qui est très susceptible à la leishmaniose. Et on a eu une épidémie de leishmaniose qui a été étudiée par les gens de Montpellier, de Marseille et des Soudanais de façon très belle il y a quelques années. Il y a des causes, alors il y a aussi des causes comportementales hein, qui favorisent la diffusion de telle ou telle bactérie ou virus. C'est le cas par exemple du virus du sida dans certaines populations. Il y a aussi des causes dues à l'environnement. Et vous avez sans doute entendu parler de la terrible épidémie de virus chikungunya à La Réunion récemment. Eh bien, en fait, ce virus qui n'est pas très épidémique normalement est arrivé dans un contexte nouveau où il n'y avait pas d'immunité de cohorte d'une part hein, dans la population, mais où il a trouvé un nouveau vecteur. Et ce nouveau vecteur était, lui, beaucoup bien meilleur transmetteur, si vous voulez. Il multipliait le virus avec une efficacité, une efficience beaucoup plus grande que le vecteur africain. Et donc, on a eu une épidémie terrible pendant plusieurs années, même 2 ans à La Réunion. J'ai parlé des migrations d'oiseaux qui peuvent être modifiées aussi. Alors, revenons brièvement à la peste dans l'histoire. C'est une maladie qui a joué un rôle important dans l'évolution sémantique de la pensée sur les épidémies. Elle a permis d'associer d'abord la notion d'épidémie au fait que c'était une seule maladie qui se diffusait, et que cette maladie arrivait par les bateaux et elle arrivait dans les ports. Et c'est vraiment ces observations-là qui ont provoqué l'apparition des premières mesures préventives contre les maladies épidémiques. Et ces premières mesures préventives, c'était la création des lazarets à Venise au XIVe siècle et au XVe siècle. Et aujourd'hui, enfin, ils se sont très vite répandus ensuite dans l'ensemble de la Méditerranée. On pourrait parler très longtemps de l'histoire des lazarets, c'est assez intéressant comme réponse, première réponse aux épidémies. Et ils ont servi très vite d'endroits où on faisait les premiers contrôles sanitaires des personnes qui arrivaient et on les mettait en quarantaine lorsque c'était nécessaire. Et puis après cette période du XVIIe siècle, il y a eu un siècle où il n'y a plus beaucoup d'épidémies en Europe, il n'y avait plus de variole ou très peu, il n'y a pas eu d'épidémie de peste, la peste n'est revenue que très peu. Et donc il a fallu attendre en fait le XIXe siècle où on a des nouvelles épidémies qui arrivent en Europe, avec la fièvre jaune à Barcelone en 1821. Et dès que la fièvre jaune revient, on s'aperçoit qu'on a une multiplication et une réhabilitation des lazarets sur l'ensemble de la Méditerranée, avec les premières régulations aussi qui arrivent. Il y a une deuxième épidémie de fièvre jaune à Gibraltar en 1828, et en 1831 sont mis en place les premiers contrôles sanitaires aux frontières. Il va falloir attendre 2 épidémies successives de choléra à Paris et en France, pour voir créer la police sanitaire en 1850 en France, et puis la convocation en 1851 de la première conférence sanitaire internationale à Paris, où 12 pays participent et 4 pays vont signer un protocole. Donc ça, c'était une initiative française, et la France a joué un très grand rôle dans la lutte internationale contre les épidémies. Donc ensuite, il va y avoir toute une série comme ça d'épidémies, de conférences sanitaires internationales, pardon, qui sont un peu rythmées parfois par les épidémies. On voit qu'il y a eu en 1865 une épidémie de choléra à Istanbul. Eh bien, la conférence suivante a lieu à Istanbul. Et donc, les épidémies, ces événements ont vraiment influencé la réaction qu'on a pu avoir pour les contrôler. Jusqu'en 1903, où à la 10e conférence sanitaire internationale a été décidée la création de l'Office international d'hygiène publique, qui a pris son siège à Paris en 1908. Et puis en 1923, la Société des Nations crée le Comité d'hygiène de la Société des Nations. Et après la Deuxième Guerre mondiale, en 1948, c'est la réunion du Comité d'hygiène de la Société des Nations et de l'Office international d'hygiène publique qui va donner lieu à la création, qui va donner naissance à l'Organisation mondiale de la santé, qui a son siège donc à Genève. Et ce qui est amusant historiquement, si vous voulez, c'est que les épidémies qui ont le plus tué d'hommes, certainement, dans le monde, sont les épidémies dues au virus de la variole, et que le premier et le seul, pour l'instant, virus que l'OMS s'est attaché à éradiquer de la surface de la Terre, c'est le virus de la variole, justement. Alors, ensuite, il y a eu, entre 1948 et 1970-80, la grande période des très bons vaccins, des antibiotiques, encore peu de résistance aux antibiotiques. Et on disait, bon, les maladies infectieuses vont disparaître petit à petit, on les contrôle très bien, il n'y a plus d'épidémie ou très peu. Et puis il y a eu l'épidémie de sida, dont on n'a pas trop parlé pour des raisons psychologiques, en fait, hein, on va dire. Enfin, on ne parlait pas comme d'une épidémie comme les autres. On en fait quelque chose de spécial, elle n'est même pas rattachée à l'OMS, elle est rattachée à l'ONU-SIDA, qui est une entité particulière. Mais il y a eu d'autres épidémies qui ont beaucoup choqué les esprits, comme les épidémies d'Ebola ou d'autres fièvres hémorragiques en Afrique centrale, en Asie, en Afrique de l'Ouest. Il y a eu la première épidémie de grippe aviaire à Hong Kong en 1997, qui a fait vraiment très très peur à tout le monde. Et puis l'épidémie de SARS en 2002, toujours en Asie du Sud-Est. Donc, à partir de la fin des années 90 et en l'an 2000, l'OMS a établi un système de réponse et de prise en charge des épidémies au niveau international. Et ce système est basé sur trois aspects, une détection précoce et une alerte, une prise en charge des épidémies, ce qu'on appelle la réponse, et un système de prévention épidémique. Alors, le système d'alerte de l'OMS s'appelle le GORN, c'est un réseau mondial d'alerte et d'action en cas d'épidémie, dont l'objectif donc, est la prévention des maladies émergentes et épidémiques qui ont un caractère, un potentiel transnational, qui peuvent dépasser les frontières, et s'appuie sur le règlement sanitaire international qui a été renouvelé, qui existe, renouvelé de là en juin de cette année, et qui demande à chaque pays de notifier et de vérifier l'apparition d'une épidémie dès qu'elle apparaît au niveau international, d'apprécier ses propres capacités de prise en charge de l'épidémie pour lutter, et éventuellement d'évaluer le risque et de fournir une assistance rapide de la part de l'OMS aux pays qui en ont besoin. Alors vous voyez, il y a dans le monde un système d'alerte comme ça, qui veille et qui, chaque jour, envoie des informations et même des rumeurs à Genève. Et ce réseau énorme est constitué d'institutions, de réseaux de partenaires et de leurs membres. Le réseau des 30 instituts Pasteur dans le monde est bien sûr fait partie de ce système d'alerte. Donc vous voyez qu'il est quand même bien réparti et assez très sophistiqué. Et puis il y a évidemment tous les bureaux régionaux de l'OMS et puis les associations comme Médecins Sans Frontières, etc. Donc tous les jours, toutes ces informations très nombreuses arrivent à Genève dans au Strategic Health Operations Center, le SHOC, où elles sont traitées et elles sont vérifiées et estimées sur un certain nombre de critères. Est-ce que c'est une maladie inconnue? Est-ce qu'elle a un caractère transnational si elle est connue? Quelle est la capacité d'interférer avec l'économie du pays? Quelle est la capacité du pays à répondre, etc. Donc chaque matin, il y a une revue des informations et des rumeurs et il y a à peu près une fois par mois ou deux fois par mois une décision d'action qui est prise, c'est-à-dire que la rumeur est vérifiée, il s'agit bien d'une épidémie à caractère dangereux transnational. Et parfois, il y a même un appel international à compétences. Alors, lorsque l'action est décidée par l'OMS, elle peut être nationale, et il va s'agir simplement donc de conseiller, de superviser la prise en charge de l'épidémie. Parfois, elle va être internationale et il va y avoir une intervention directe de l'OMS dans le pays. Après, généralement, un appel à compétences auprès du CDC d'Atlanta, auprès de l'Institut Pasteur de Paris, auprès d'Épicentre, MSF, etc. On fait appel à des épidémiologistes spécialisés, des microbiologistes, des gens qui prennent en charge les cas. L'association française Épicentre est vraiment le bras droit de l'OMS dans ce domaine-là. Et puis parfois on envoie une équipe in situ, par exemple, je me souviens avoir participé à l'envoi d'une équipe sur une épidémie de grippe assez dangereuse à Madagascar il y a quelques années. Alors maintenant, au niveau international, voilà quelle est l'action, la réponse que l'on peut donner aux épidémies, l'organisation, si vous voulez, internationale. En France, on est généralement concerné par les épidémies qui sont limitées à notre pays, bien entendu, et c'est le rôle de l'Institut de veille sanitaire, mais qui peut être appuyé par l'INSERM ou par l'Institut Pasteur, où on a créé une cellule d'intervention biologique d'urgence pour intervenir en France ou à l'étranger en cas de problème. C'est une cellule donc qui a le côté microbiologique, si vous voulez, du système. L'Institut de veille sanitaire, lui, fournit les épidémiologistes proprement dit. Alors je voudrais donner maintenant, pour terminer, un exemple de prévention des épidémies, puisqu'on en est maintenant au stade où on va plus loin que la prise en charge. On a des systèmes qui essaient de prévenir les épidémies. Et j'ai pris l'exemple de la dengue en Nouvelle-Calédonie. Donc la dengue est une maladie qui est due à un virus, lequel est transmis aux hommes par un vecteur qui s'appelle Aedes aegypti pour la Nouvelle-Calédonie, qui est un vecteur domestique qui vit dans des gîtes près des hommes. La maladie est très souvent épidémique avec des taux d'attaque très élevés. Il existe 4 sérotypes du virus de la dengue et un sérotype donne une immunité contre le même sérotype, mais pas contre les sérotypes voisins ou très mal. L'incubation de la maladie est très courte, ce qui nous impose des contraintes d'autant plus grandes pour la réponse et la prise en charge de ces épidémies. Le virus de la dengue est généralement introduit dans un pays par les malades qui arrivent d'une zone infectée connue, ou bien, plus rarement, par des moustiques infectés par le virus. Donc il existe un certain nombre de principes de prévention épidémique de la dengue. Premièrement, le premier principe, si vous voulez, c'est d'éviter l'introduction du virus dans une zone susceptible. Une zone susceptible, c'est une zone où le vecteur est présent et où le climat, au moment où le virus peut arriver, va permettre la diffusion la multiplication du vecteur et la diffusion du virus. Donc. Ensuite, le deuxième principe, c'est d'avoir en permanence un système de surveillance, de monitorage et de lutte contre les vecteurs. C'est ce qui manquait à l'île de la Réunion, où ça avait été supprimé depuis plusieurs années, depuis une dizaine d'années. Et le fait de ne pas avoir d'équipe et de ne pas avoir en permanence un système de surveillance des vecteurs a eu des conséquences vraiment dramatiques. Ensuite, il faut avoir un système de détection très précoce des nouveaux cas, sur le plan clinique et sur le plan biologique, d'autant plus précoce que la maladie, je vous disais, a une incubation très courte. Et ensuite, une fois que le virus est arrivé, eh bien, il faut éviter à tout prix le passage entre les hommes et les vecteurs. Donc à chacune de ces grands principes, on a un certain nombre d'outils qui permettent d'y répondre. Pour éviter l'introduction, on fait une démoustication systématique et très soigneuse dans les avions qui proviennent des pays de zones infectées. À l'heure actuelle, il y a une épidémie importante à Tahiti. Eh bien, les avions qui viennent de Tahiti à Nouméa sont vraiment très soigneusement démoustiqués chaque semaine, donc chaque vol. On donne une information aux passagers qui arrivent d'une zone infectée. Ça semble être un peu surprenant, mais en fait, ça marche très bien. C'est-à-dire qu'on dit aux passagers, vous venez d'une zone atteinte de telle épidémie, la dengue, là, en l'occurrence. Donc, si vous avez tel et tel signe clinique dans les 5 jours qui arrivent, dites bien à votre médecin, dites bien à votre médecin que vous venez de cette zone-là. Et puis en fait aussi, la dernière chose, c'est quand vous arrivez à la frontière, vous êtes peut-être déjà non plus en incubation, mais en début de maladie, et en début de maladie de dengue, vous avez de la fièvre, comme beaucoup de maladies, et donc sans le savoir ou en le sachant, vous êtes filmé, et si vous apparaissez rouge sur la caméra thermique, on vous appelle et on vous demande de prendre un certain nombre de précautions et on vérifie si c'est de la dengue ou non. Et ça marche. L'autre jour, on a détecté un malade de la dengue et il a accepté de faire une quarantaine personnelle, volontaire. Et on a évité comme ça l'arrivée de la diffusion d'un virus. Ensuite, surveiller et lutter contre les vecteurs. Donc on a tous les mois une surveillance qui nous donne un certain nombre d'indices entomologiques qui nous permettent d'adapter la lutte exactement à l'endroit où on le veut. Ça nous permet aussi de faire de l'éducation pour la santé. On fait du porte-à-porte, les journées dingues par les médias, etc. On surveille la susceptibilité des vecteurs aux insecticides. Et on a en permanence donc des équipes bien équipées, bien entraînées de lutte antivectorielle. Donc vous voyez que on répond pas à une épidémie par un seul, le vaccin miracle ou une chose. C'est vraiment un système sophistiqué et réfléchi qui nous permet d'avancer. Et c'est pas fini. On a ensuite un système de détection précoce des nouveaux cas par une information très très forte et permanente des médecins praticiens, un système de sentinelles, de médecins sentinelles qui sont particulièrement sensibilisés au problème, la déclaration obligatoire des cas qui nous permet de les localiser ou des cas suspects. Et puis, on a mis en place au laboratoire des systèmes extrêmement rapides en quelques heures de confirmation du virus de la dengue par RT-PCR. Enfin, limiter le virus une fois qu'il est introduit. On a tout un tas d'outils comme ça. Simplement, ce sur quoi il faut insister, c'est que lorsqu'on a un cas suspect qui est arrivé, on essaie d'une part de voir si c'est un cas primaire ou un cas secondaire. Un cas primaire, c'est un cas importé, c'est-à-dire c'est un malade qui a été infecté à Tahiti et qui déclare sa maladie une fois qu'il est en Nouvelle-Calédonie. Donc c'est un cas qui n'y a pas de moustique pour le moment infecté. Alors qu'un cas secondaire, c'est quelqu'un qui n'est pas sorti du territoire, donc qui a forcément été infecté par un moustique, ce qui veut dire qu'il y avait déjà, le virus est déjà sorti de l'homme, il est déjà passé dans l'environnement moustique, en vecteur. Donc c'est pour ça qu'on fait des traitements périfocaux autour de tous les cas suspects. On détruit vraiment tous les moustiques et parfois ils font même ce qu'ils appellent des frappes de zone, surtout s'il y a autour des cas secondaires. Donc vous voyez, on a ici, là je vais terminer, mais simplement on a toute une série, une cascade comme ça d'actions. Et à chacune de ces actions correspondent soit les médecins praticiens, généralistes, des épidémiologistes, le service municipal d'hygiène, le laboratoire, etc., etc. Donc c'est un système assez sophistiqué et qui marche, puisque par exemple en 2006, et c'est encore plus beau en 2007 d'ailleurs, on a eu chaque barre noire signifie l'importation d'un cas, et chaque fois on a pu voir si c'était un cas importé, primaire, ou un cas secondaire. Et vous voyez, on a eu que le premier cas était un cas qui venait d'Indonésie, le deuxième venait de La Réunion, le troisième, il venait de Tahiti, mais il y a eu derrière le cas de Tahiti deux autres cas secondaires. Donc là, le virus a sauté, on va dire, d'un homme à l'autre à travers les moustiques. Et ensuite, on a eu d'autres cas. Alors, depuis le début de l'année, là, on a eu 17 cas comme ça importés, donc beaucoup de cas secondaires, on a eu très peur, mais on a réussi à maintenir le pays sans épidémie. En 2001, le système a échappé. Et il y a eu presque 15 000 cas de dengue en quelques mois en Nouvelle-Calédonie. Donc faire tout ce système assez sophistiqué, ça permet d'éviter quand même des dizaines de milliers de cas de maladies. Voilà, je vous remercie.
Merci. Ben, nous allons accueillir l'intervenant suivant.
Bien. Alors, Serge Planton va nous parler des impacts du changement climatique sur les événements climatiques extrêmes. C'est un sujet qui a déjà été abordé lors de la séance de l'après-midi d'hier, mais je pense que Serge va nous faire un panorama d'ensemble et chercher à détecter finalement quels sont les événements climatiques extrêmes qui sont le plus vraisemblablement affectés par le changement climatique.
So, thank you. Yes, we have. You had yesterday some presentation about the future of some climatic extremes like tropical cyclone, and I will not insist on it, but I will try to do, as I said just before by Michel Petit, to do some panorama of what we know from the modelization concerning the impact of climate change on the climatic extremes. And so first I will make a short introduction on the subject, and then I will come to the presentation of the main conclusion of the IPCC, and I will also present some new results which are using the recent simulation from IPCC. And then the second part of the main part of the presentation will be on some downscaling methodology that gives some also information on the what could be the extremes at a very small scale, regional scale, and I will focus particularly on France, but only as an example, because the methodology are general, of course. And so, as an introduction, I will come back to a sentence from Katz in 1998. He said that despite we had in the recent years some discussion about extreme events, in fact, there is a little application of statistical series of extremes applied to climatological diagnostics. And this conclusion, in fact, remains because it was also given by in a recent report from IPCC, from a 2002 report. And even yesterday, Philippe Naveau also had some sort of conclusion. And this is right, that we have a lot to do with the application of this statistical series to the analysis of extremes. But, and I show just an example of Karin and Svir, and Philippe also presented some results, more recent results from Karin and Svir, concerning the application of statistical theory. It is an adjustment of the generalized extreme value theoretical curves to the results of GCMs, of general circulation models, climate models. And they have, for example, here calculated the return value, the 20-year return value of precipitation, but just using a 20 years length period of a period of 20 years of data from the model, so it's some sort of extrapolation, of course, because we're not sure that even in this period of 20-year data we can observe such an event. So this type of method can be applied for very extreme value, of course. And so they have calculated this for the period here of the mid-century, of this century, and the end of this century. And we can see, of course, an amplification, but also some non-linearities, as we can observe, for example, in this case over Africa, that there is a region where we have some signal that disappear when considering the end of the century. This shows, even at this stage, some linearities. Of course, since this previous work, pioneer work, we had a lot of analysis of climate extremes in the several international projects. I have cited only two, MICE and STARDEX. And I will also give some example from a national French national project in France and Supreme. From MICE, we had example of studies of the impact of and extreme the impact of extreme events over certain regions of Europe, impact on tourism, impact on the forestry, and so on. And from STARDEX, we had some now some new way to analyze the streams from the climate model simulations. They have developed new methodologies, and they have also proposed some standard, also definition that are very useful for the model intercomparison and for analysis of extremes. And I will give some more detail about the national programs later on. And to end this introduction, I present here some classical view of the analysis of extreme. Of course, extreme are only the tails of some distribution. If we suppose here for temperature that we have some Gaussian distribution, extreme are defined as the value that are exceeding some threshold or that are lower than some threshold for the cold events. And the impact of climate change could be of two sorts. It can infer some displacement of the distribution as a whole due to the warming. It is represented in the top figure. And these, of course, generate more extreme values according to the same threshold that the one that is defined for the present climate. But also we can have some change of the variability, and this implies a change of the shape of the distribution. And in this case, we can have more warm events, but also more cold events. And the reality, in fact, is that we have a combination of the two, as demonstrated, for example, recently for data over France. We have a combination of the shift of the distribution and also change of variability. And this implies an even more increase of warm extremes. So what are the main learnings from IPCC? I have extracted this table from the summary for policymakers, and we can see that according to the phenomena, we have different statements. We have here the statement concerning the observation over the 20th century, and also according to the projection, which is the main topic of my talk. And we can see, for example, that for heat waves, it is very likely, and very likely this means in the standard language of IPCC, more than 80% of probability, we should experience an increase of the intensity of the frequency of warm events here. It is the point that is made. We should also experience very likely an increase of the intensity of precipitation. And according to also a draft, it is only likely here, likely that means over 66% of probability. We should experience also a more frequent extension of the region which are affected by draft. And according to cyclones, and this was the main topic of the talk of Jean-Claude André yesterday, we should experience likely an increase of the activity of intense cyclones. I must say, as he said before, that this conclusion is mainly supported by some recent results which have been obtained with very high-resolution models. So what is said about other extremes to complete this table is that We have also a lot of confidence on the impact of climate change on the frost days. They are projected to occur almost a decrease of frost days is projected to occur almost everywhere in the mid and high latitudes. And also, which is important for ecosystem, an increase of the growing season length. And we have less certainty concerning the impact of climate change on the storms. And this is, for example, the statement which is done in one chapter of the IPCC report. I read it for those who cannot read it. Model projections show fewer mid-latitude storm average over each hemisphere associated with poleward shift of the storm tracks. That is particularly notable in the southern hemisphere, with lower central pressure for these poleward shifted storms. And this is, in fact, likely the same statement that was done from the third assessment report, with more intense events possible, but possible also reduce number of total number of storms. And what is new from the last report is more evidence of poleward shift of the storm tracks. And the increase of wind speed results also in more extreme wave 8 in the regions where these storms are shifted. And concerning what can be, to some extent, called extreme events, even if they are not, in fact, extreme events in the climatological point of view, but they can be concerning the impact of these events. And I have added this because this was discussed in the previous days. The change of El Niño, and it was also said by Jean-Claude André yesterday in response to one question. In fact, we have no clear view of what could be the impact of climate change of this kind of events. The results of the models are very different from one to another. So um, I will now present some new calculation that had been made from IPCC simulation that are not published in the report, but had been published in the scientific literature very recently. And they are based upon the simulation that had been done by the French community. This view graph has been presented yesterday also by Hervé Le Trut. It shows the results of the two French models according to the change of precipitation. In blue, it means an increase of precipitation, and in orange, a decrease of precipitation, according also to two different scenarios, classical A2 and B1 scenario, relatively high and relatively low scenario. And I come now to some diagnostics from this specific simulation that show some particular extremes. First of all, I present the number of days of heat waves. The definition takes into account the intensity of the event, but also its duration. To define a heat wave, we have, and this is in fact some standard defined from the Stardex project I mentioned before. The idea is here to characterize the heat waves not only by in intensity but also by its duration. The temperature must be higher by 5 degrees from the normal over a period of at least 6 days. And from the two models, all the maps I present are differences between the end of this century compared to present climate. And we can see that we have an increase of the number of days in the two simulations, whatever the color, this is an increase. But the color shows also that the colors shows that there is a geographical distribution of these changes that are not always in accordance between the two models. So, and particularly at higher latitudes, this can be attributed to different ways of reproducing the interaction between surface and the atmosphere, and particularly snow cover and the atmosphere. But at least at mid-latitudes and over tropical areas, we have consistency between the two maps. So this is, a very important increase of this number of heat waves. Also, what we can see is here is that we should also experience an increase of in heavy precipitation events, as this diagnostic shows it. Here, it is the number of days with precipitation greater than 10 millimeters per day. It is relatively low, in fact, per 10 millimeter. We have here to consider that we have to adapt the definition of extreme to the ability of our models to reproduce them. This is the reason why the threshold is relatively low. But this is an indication of the fact that in the model, in some regions, this corresponds to orange and red colors, we should experience an increase of heavy precipitation events as calculated by the model, and a decrease in blue, mainly in tropical region. In fact, this is consistent with the map of mean precipitation change. So this is the case for the repartition of the change. It is similar for the extreme values and for the mean values. But we must say also that, in fact, the increase of the extreme is greater than the increase of the mean in the relative value. And the last parameter and diagnostic I would like to show is the number of days, of draft days, in fact, with consecutive days with precipitation lower than 1 millimeter. And here again, we find some consistency between this map of change and the previous map with something new, in fact, that at mid-latitudes, we experience an increase of draft and frequency, and even if in winter we have shown just before that we should have an increase of heavy precipitation. This is a characteristics of a characteristic of climate change, we should have at the same time an increase of heavy events at mid latitudes, heavy precipitation events in winter, and drought duration in summer. So an increase of the seasonal cycle, seasonal hydrological cycle. But of course, I have only shown two models, and we have seen on these maps that there is some differences when we are looking at some specific region. And this is here stressed by a comparison of eight different models from IPCC, and this is a recent calculation that had been done. This is the same index than before applied to the draft. The draft duration, and with eight models from IPCC runs, and with some focus over for Europe and Africa. And we can see that there is some similarities and great differences according to the different regions. The similarities, we have them on the region of Mediterranean area and southern Europe, northern Africa. We can see that whatever the model, we have the same sign, which shows an increasing of the draft duration. But over Africa and over the monsoon region, we have a lot of discrepancy between the different models. And this reflects also what we have for other regions, also for the Indian monsoon area. We also show that for some models we can have an increase and for other models a decrease. This reflects that we have more uncertainty over some region than over other regions. Also, another way to see how uncertain as same diagnostic according to the two models and for the triangles over the USA region. This is a comparison to data. Of course, I don't insist upon the comparison to data, but of course, all these studies are supported by also the direct comparison to data for the present climate conditions. So here, what we can see is that we have some variability, not only at interannual scale, but also at decadal and multi-decadal scale. It is particularly apparent for the Europe region and for the EPSL model, for example, because it is more clear in this case. And we can see also that we have this same variability. So I show it for the for this region, for Europe. We have also this sort of variability for the Mediterranean region. And of course, this posed the question, this make us to ask if it is in fact possible to detect some change in extreme events, like here the draft frequency. We can see that it is of course difficult because the variability, this variability at the decadal scale is mainly of natural origin, and so this variability can mask any signal of change that remains relatively low over the last decades, and it will also be relatively low over the next decades. I will show some example in the following. So now I come to results that have been obtained not only using IPCC simulation, but using this simulation and a next step of downscaling, which is a statistical or dynamical downscaling. What is the difference? It was explained by Philippe Navo yesterday. With dynamical downscaling, what we try to do is to simulate the variability at a lower scale, but using a physical model. And in the statistical downscaling, we try also to reduce the scale of the diagnostic, but only using statistical methods that had been adjusted on observations. So the first step of dynamical downscaling, I begin with this, is to use some regional climate models that allow to reproduce the variability at a finer scale than the large-scale models. Typically, large-scale models are producing variability at a scale of a few hundred kilometers, 200 to 300 kilometers. This is the size of the mesh. And here we are, the size of the mesh is about 50 kilometers. And we have a representation, for example, of the grids from the two French regional climate models. And I will show some results from different scenarios. This is the reason why I present this graph. As you know, with the different concentration according to different socioeconomic and demographic hypotheses, I will present some results from the A2 in orange on the figure and the B1 in green on the figure and A1B scenario in red on the figure. That means that the first is a relatively high scenario, the second is a relatively low, and the third is a relatively median scenario. So I present here a diagnostic of the number of heat wave days as with the same diagnostic than the one in the I presented before. But using now the one of the regional climate model simulation, but with three different scenarios. And we can see also in the figure that different decades had been identified. These are all in projection, but we have there the, only the first part of this century. And what we can see, and what it is relatively surprising, is that even for the highest scenario, we can have less heat wave change than for the medium scenario. Even this medium scenario is higher than the is of the same order of magnitude of the lower. Even the lower is even greater than has a greater impact. And this can be explained by what I showed on the curves previously. It is linked to the regional variability, internal variability at the regional scale, which explained that for some decades we can have an amplification of the response, which is due to a combination of internal variability and the signal of climate change that remains relatively low for this period. And in fact, with this figure, we cannot distinguish the different scenarios. We know that for the mean temperature, and it is also here demonstrated for the extreme values for the heat waves, and even some medium scenarios can give higher values of heat wave change, but this depends, in fact, on the way the model reproduces internal variability. But this is not the same view for the future for the end of this century and for the second part of this century, because that there we can see that the scenarios are more distinguishable with the higher giving the highest response, the A2 scenarios giving an increase of the heat wave day number by a factor of about 10 here. And so there is a hierarchy between the model response that corresponds here to the hierarchy of the amplitude of CO2 in the atmosphere, CO2 concentration. Here there is a focus on this higher scenario with the same diagnostics, only to indicate you that it is possible to recover these sort of maps on the website. The address is indicated here. Because this result is extracted from the so-called IMFREX French project, Impact du changement climatique sur la fréquence des événements extrêmes, and on this site we can recover this sort of maps in projection, but also comparison to observation for the same diagnostics. And so we can see here this factor of 10, of about 10, of in the number of heat wave days. We recover here at the regional scale what was also observed with the results of the large-scale models, with an increase of the number also of heavy precipitation days. And also an increase of the duration of the heat waves. I must also to say that an analysis, close analysis of the research showed that according to the increase of the number of heat and intensity and duration of heat waves, we also see that it is a consequence not only on the shift of the mean, but also there is an increase of variability, as it had been observed, so as I said it before, for the data of the last decades. We also see it in the model, and this could be explained by the interaction between the draft and the increase of temperature, because we know that draft has an impact on the increase of the severity of the temperature change. And I have said nothing up to now concerning the impact of climate change on the wind, except the general IPCC conclusion. And here we have also some first step for the regionalization of the impact of climate change according to the wind speed. And this is also a return level, but here a 50-year return level that had been calculated by extrapolation, statistical extrapolation of the results of the model. And we can see that these maps have very low consistency between the two models. We see that there is perhaps only the western part of France that is affected by the same kind of response, but this reflects, in fact, a lot of uncertainty according to this particular diagnostic. And to end my presentation, I would like to focus on preliminary results. It is, in fact, preliminary because it concerns mainly the methodological part of the research. It is a study of the impact of climate change on the heavy precipitation that are occurring in southeastern France, the so-called Événement Cévenol. And first of all, to introduce it, I show statistics from observation of the last 40 years that show the number of such events in the recent decades, and we can see that there is here again a lot of variability, as it had been shown, for example, for the tropical cyclone yesterday, and variability which is existing at the interannual and at the decadal, multi-decadal scale. That is the observation of the occurrence. I have to say that these events are relatively rare, and because the threshold value corresponds to very heavy precipitation. It is the level is which is chosen here is 190 millimeters per day. And so I show the methodology which is currently applied in an ongoing project which is called the CIPRIM project, to show that it is possible even with large-scale simulations and the signal of very that can be obtained from the dissimulation to derive some information about such events, which are, of course, far to be reproduced directly by the modelization, because the scale of this phenomenon is only a few kilometers to a few tens of kilometers. So what is this methodology? It is a combination, in fact, of statistics and dynamical downscaling. The first step is to try to identify some climate regimes at the large scales which are favorable to the occurrence of the heavy precipitation events. And this can be done only by analysis of data, of course. This has been done by using the data reanalysis over 40 years from the European Center and precipitation observation over the southeastern France. And then when identifying, after identifying the large-scale regimes, we can try to see if the model is able to reproduce this specific regime at large scale, and when this is the case, if it is possible to downscale the result from the large-scale model with a mesoscale model, here the so-called meso-NH model. And so the first step of the feasibility study is now accomplished, but not the impact of climate change on the specific events. And I showed some very few results for this feasibility study. On the first figures, the first column, we have identification of two cases of heavy precipitation in the climate model, first of all. And we can see that in this case, we have some configuration that resemble some heavy precipitation events in the southeastern France. But these are precipitation calculated by the model. And then when we introduce the large scale simulated by the climate model as a constraint of the mesoscale model, which is illustrated here by these maps, I don't insist on the significance, but the idea is there. We try to constrain the mesoscale model with the result from the large-scale model. The mesoscale model is able to reproduce events which are very comparable to observation, with levels of 270 millimeters, for example, in the case 1, and 467 millimeter for the second one. So we know that only with the information of the large scale we can downscale this information at the level of the heavy precipitation event. And this is, of course, very promising because we know that if models now are, of course, unable to produce such events directly, there are more predictability in the large-scale systems that are reproduced by these models. So my conclusion is that certain changes, impact of climate changes on extreme events, are relatively certain. It is the case for less frost days, increased intensity, frequency, and duration of heat waves, heavy precipitation more frequent in winter, and also some changes remain uncertain. It is, for example, the magnitude of the change for the precipitation, the intensity of also of storms at mid latitudes, the geographic distribution of the change, particularly for those parameters which are linked to the hydrological cycle. And these uncertainties are due, as roughly illustrated this, to the models themselves. We have seen that different models produce in some regions very different results. To the scenarios, we have seen that scenarios give also contrasted responses, at least at the end of this century. And of course, natural variability of climate, as I have illustrated it in the case of Europe and the case of France. We have also seen that the statistic characteristics of the events should evolve very non-linearly. This is important because for the next decades, we have it can be considered as a paradox. We have less predictability than for the end of this century because it is, in fact, a question of a ratio between the signal to noise, and the noise is very important for the next decade. And we have also seen that some techniques combining statistics and models, it was also stressed yesterday by Philippe Naveau, are very promising to try to reduce the scale of the events that could be inferred from in the analysis. And at last, of course, one good practice is certainly to use multi-model ensembles and multi-scenario in order to give some idea on the impact of climate change, because we have seen that there is a lot of variability which is associated to models and scenarios. So, thank you.
Vous venez d'entendre le météorologue Serge Planton. Il revenait en détail sur le rôle des bouleversements climatiques, sur les événements climatiques extrêmes du type typhon ou ouragan. Son intervention était précédée par celle de Paul Martin, chercheur à l'Institut Pasteur de Nouvelle-Calédonie, attaché quant à lui au déclenchement d'épidémies suite aux événements climatiques extrêmes. Nous marquons une pause avant de retrouver Laurent Mermet et ses recherches sur des événements futurs. À tout de suite. Retour à notre retransmission du colloque Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes, organisé par l'Académie des sciences en juillet 2007. Laurent Mermet, de l'École nationale du génie rural, des eaux et des forêts, étudie les situations environnementales encore non existantes pour prévenir et se prémunir contre les événements climatiques extrêmes. Sa communication est en anglais, on l'écoute.
What I'm going to speak about this morning is the challenges that are raised by the fact of studying future events, situations, or ecosystems. When we are saying that we want to prepare for extreme events, the first characteristic that comes to mind is the fact that these events are situated in the future, mega floods or big storms, etc. They are not just for tomorrow morning. They are going to happen at a certain time. And if we want to prepare for these events, then we have to study the situations that are going to occur. And these situations are sometime in the future, maybe 2 years from now, maybe 50 years from now, or 80 years from now. And clearly, it is a challenge to study situations that are not there, available for study, in the way that a forest is here, if you want to study how it works today. And the fact that there are extreme events is also a challenge, as was explained by some of the speakers. The material is not available. It's difficult to experiment on these situations. There are exceptions, like the El Niño events. There are extremes that you can predict, but others are just not studiable in that way. With Xavier Pux, Hubert Kicken, Sébastien Trayer, and Ruud van der Helm, we led a 9-year research project to try and sort out these challenges of seriously studying situations that are in the future. And that resulted in this book and its companion bibliographical book. We also organized in 2001 a summer university for interdisciplinary teams working on ecosystems to discuss with them on how it was possible to study future situations. And now, all the main message of the book and this research is that currently the general view is that scientists ought to understand how systems work now or in the past. And then, when they want to speak about the future, they discuss in hybrid forums with politicians, decision makers, or with society, so that the study of future systems is not so much a scholarly or an academic study as a policy-oriented or decision-making-oriented study. And our argument is that the study of future systems and situation should also be undertaken within academia. Future scenarios or models should be discussed within academia and not only at the interface between academia and the policy-making scene. And coherent with that belief, I am now starting work with Audrey Corot, who is at the back of the room there. We're starting a dissertation on possibilities within ecology as a discipline to increase the possibility of research on future state dynamics and functioning of ecosystems. The outline of my talk this morning is going to start with an overview of the challenges and the possible contributions of the future studies fields to those disciplines and research efforts that are trying to study future ecologies or future extreme events. Then I will turn to the difficulties that are inherent in those disciplines and that make it difficult for them to embark on the study of future systems as contrasted with past or present systems. And then I'll end up with some perspectives. What are the challenges? I said a word already about future situations and systems. If you think about all the aspects of your research that relies on the systems being concretely here for study when you study the present, or that rely on material traces of the past, either archaeological or geological or archives or paleontological, imagine that you have to do without all those elements. And this is precisely the situation when you are planning to study future situations and events. On the extreme events, there are similarities and differences between extreme events and events that are just future, like a constant rate of temperature and the future ecosystems it can create. The similarities are the fact that they are very difficult to apprehend, but the differences are the short duration of the catastrophic event, and this has very big consequences. Just one that interests me, organizationally, it makes a very big difference. If there is a catastrophe 20 years from now, and it lasts for 2 weeks, the organizational situation is less complex than if you have a transformation that is occurring over 50 years and organizations evolve and react to the situation. Now, most academic disciplines have difficulty to study these future situations, and I'll say more about that. But also it must be said that there is social ambiguity about the will or the need to study this situation. It's a mixture of curiosity, but also of resistance and reluctance. Just one example, we're studying climate change at a time scale of, say, 90 years. Can anybody imagine that the geopolitical situation of the Earth in 90 years from now is going to be similar to the current geopolitical situation? I don't think that is a very serious hypothesis. But it's very difficult to use credible geopolitical hypotheses, that is, hypotheses that are radically different from the current situation of the planet, as a basis for serious work on climate research. This is just to illustrate that. Studying these challenges of long-term and even maybe catastrophic evolutions is not a new challenge. The challenge has been repeatedly formulated and met in the 70s with the Meadows Report, in the 80s with Clarks and Mann, great book on sustainable development of the biosphere, in the 90s with the image model, in the 2000s by the IPCC or Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And it's very interesting to see how the challenge has been formulated and treated at these various stages. What is the current situation? If I can summarize it very briefly, first, there are very interesting achievements in some areas, like global climate, and the economics of energy, or in demography. These are sub-disciplines that have invested heavily in studying future systems or dynamics. If we look at other areas like ecosystems or biodiversity, or studying the long-term dynamics of water systems, or studying the futures of forests, for instance, then studies are very rare. And also, there are many, many more studies at a global level than at a local or regional level, for quite good reasons. So the current challenge is to expand from those fields that have invested in studying futures to other fields. Just an example, it would be very interesting to study the possible dynamics over 80 years of this or that French forest, taking into account the various forces, both social or ecological, that can play on these forests. It's important to realize that during all these attempts at studying future ecologies in the last 30 years or 35 years, there has been an ongoing crossover between the disciplines that are very apparent in these exercises, like climatology, ecology, economics, and specialists of future studies, the little disciplinary field that is specialized in the problems that are associated with studying future situations. If you look at past exercises, like the famous, both at the exercise that I already cited and to others, like the report of to the president of 1980, policy exercise in the 80s, policy dialogues in the 90s, the World Water Vision more recently, in all these exercises, you can find some characters that are atypical characters that are not economists or ecologists, but people who are specialized in scenario methodologies, who are critics of modeling, sociologists of science, and in all those academic fora. So you have some gray sheep, like I myself was in the policy dialogues at IASA in the 80s. Discreetly, but in a very strong way, these people have transferred from the field of future studies to the field of large-scale environmental systems a lot of methodological tools, like scenario methods, and a lot of theoretical frameworks or solutions that are currently nested in those studies and that are, in my view, not discussed enough. So what I'm pleading for is to renew and to make much more explicit this transfer from future studies to the various fields involved in environmental research and working on future. What is this field of future studies? If you read journals like Futures, which is the best known international journal, you will discover that there is a worldwide community of academics who are working on future dynamics, on what's going to happen to people, to countries, to the energy, to this, to that. What have they been doing for the last 40 years? They have been doing three things, basically. First, they have created methodologies, and for instance, there are dozens of different methodologies to build scenarios. Three or four of these methodologies have found their ways to the community that works on environmental futures. The second thing they do is what are called sophisticated commentary on futures. Basically, these people have been thinking hard for the last 40 years on all the specific difficulties of studying future situations by opposition to present or past situations. And they have come up with many publications about theory and epistemology that I think, are one of the most interesting assets that could be used by the community of environmental researchers who want to work on future systems. And the third thing that they've been doing is that they've been building conjectures, that is, studies on possible future state of affairs that can be used as frameworks to study more specialized issues. Imagine, for instance, that I try to study the Forêt de la Harte in Alsace in 250. Obviously, I will have to imagine a social context, an economic context, a climatic context, etc. The climatic one, no problem. I will talk with my colleagues whom I know. But what about the social and economic ones? Well, if there exists somewhere people who have been working about the future evolution of population in Europe, or the evolution of the culture of people in Europe, or the evolution of the location of economic development in Europe, that will be of importance to me. If we want to study seriously a specific future ecological system, we will have to use reference works for context elements that are needed for the study of that ecosystem. And the creation and maintenance of such reference studies is the object of academic work, and it has to increase tremendously if we want to be able to be as good on the social or economic context than we try to be on rainfall variation, for instance. So tending to this vastly extending repertoire of conjecture is the new is one of the new challenges for both future studies that go across all the type of issues, not only ecosystems or extreme events. And that's a concern that ought to be shared by environmental researchers who work on extreme events. So the attempt to study these events is not new. What is the current state of the art? The current state of the art relies on a formula, a certain way of solving the problem that is usually called integrated assessment. It is, for instance, the formula that defines the way the IPCC or the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment have been run, but it also is used for works at other scales. What does it say? This formula rests on the idea that the study of ecological futures has mostly to take place at the interface between research and policy. The vision of integrated assessment is that we ought to mobilize all the academic resources about a certain futures problem, and we ought to create an ad hoc organization whereby the people who have the academic expertise work together and worked in mixed panels with decision makers, politicians, or soft experts, so to speak, of social and economic aspects. There are strong limits to that way of doing things. Big achievements have been obtained this way, like the IPCC panel, or to a lesser extent, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. But there are intrinsic limits that are quite stern in this way of doing business, and this is what I'm going to try and show now. To do that, I'll start with showing what exactly the difficulties are that disciplines meet when they try to move from studying the present and the past to studying future events. This is based on a research project in the National Wetland Research Program, led by Xavier Poux, that was trying to design future methodology to study future conditions of wetlands at a local scale. Within that project, interviews were conducted with various scientists to ask them, what do you think in your own disciplines are crucial resources that could be used to work more on future states and dynamics? What in your discipline are stumbling blocks that prevent or make more difficult the study of future situations? And in the Camargue, we have two examples. One example is a scientist who is working on the analysis of specialized dynamic series. So what he's doing is collecting data, specialized data, for instance, on the extension of rice cultivation, on the evolution of duck populations of various species, on water levels, on temperature, on economic data about farming, the farming situation. And then they look for correlation that they can validate for the present and the past. If they want, so what they're saying is, this is a resource to study the future, because then we can project these correlations into the future and make strongly based hypotheses about the future situations. That's the strength. The weakness is the fact that there is no evidence that the structures of the system that are at the basis of the past and present correlations will continue to exist in the future, and that their way of doing research is not well equipped to deal with that aspect of the problem. Now, take the historians who have been working in great detail about the Camargue and about many other places. They, by contrast, have a very, very precise understanding of the transformation of situations and situation structure over time. They can see human societies transforming themselves, transforming the ecosystems they live in, etc. So you might think, if you are the specialists of studying the unraveling of human and ecological systems over time, then you're the best people to continue and try to unravel future transformations. But if you talk with a historian, he will tell you that you are not allowed to say anything in history if you do not have an archive or an archaeological trace. So there are very strong barriers, the very criteria that serve to assess the academic quality of a piece of work in history forbid mobilizing the incredible theoretical resources of history for studying long-term transformations to use them to study future situations. These are two examples of both the immense resources that there are in disciplines and of the difficulties that will have to be overcome if we want to embark on serious studies of future situations. Let's go a bit deeper in that. It's a spectacular evolution that has taken place over the last 30 years that has rehistoricized ecosystems and the relations between humans and ecosystems. Historians, archaeologists, etc., have shown us in utmost detail that what we perceived as rather stable or permanent systems were in fact in long-term evolution processes, and this was a major consideration. There is a strong apparent logic in coupling hindsight and foresight. In French, we would say rétrospective et prospective. If we understand in depth the past, we ought automatically to be in a position to understand the future. But this continuity is not really a continuity, because we found out in France through the Zone Atelier research program that the call to research teams to study the long term, irrespective of it being the past or the present, has not worked. There is a breaking point between past and present and the future in terms of what we can study, how we can do it, the epistemological issues, etc. And it's both underestimated sometimes and overestimated. But I don't have much time to elaborate just now. How? I believe that the main, one of the main obstacles when scientists embark on studying the future is the attraction of forecast. It's the idea that the main aim of any serious piece of work on the future should be to forecast what is going to happen. For instance, a paper in 2003, I think, by Clark and a whole bunch of other authors in science calls for a union of ecologists to increase the forecasting capacity of ecology. In 1977, Godet founded the modern approach to perspective with a book called Crisis of Forecasting and Emergence of Future Studies. What it says is that basically the future is not forecastable. You cannot forecast the condition of large human systems over decades in a credible way. What you can do is study possible future conditions, possible future functioning, possible future dynamics of future ecological systems. And since these systems are highly anthropic now, of future social ecological systems. It's a mental reframing that is very difficult, but it's necessary if you want to be able to work on futures seriously. Let's take an example, which is the current focus on models as the major or even the only way to work on futures. Okay, here we have a very simplified version of what many of you are doing. You have theories and facts. You deduce a certain model that you treat as a hypothesis. You create predictions with the models. You look for new data. And if the new data said that the model was right, fine. If they say the model was wrong, then you go back to your work table. And what you can say if you're working on something that is repetitive enough and that is nested in a stable enough context, if you do that seriously enough, then in the end, you'll be able to say what you call a prediction in terms of modeling can also become a forecast or a prevision. However, we're talking here about systems of which we know which are not repetitive. If I'm trying to forecast or to study the condition of European forests in 50 years from now, I don't think we have much repetition of the sequence of events that may occur between now and 2080. And also the context within which the European forest system is nested is not that stable that I could trust that method. What's the result? The result is that this feedback loop that is in the research design does not work well. And so what we do is that we have to replace it partially by other things. If you look at the Millennium Assessment or at the IPCC or any of the current works, they all rest on a mixture of modeling and scenarios. What they are doing is this. They are mixing models and other sorts of constructed conjectures, like the scenarios of the IPCC reports or the scenarios of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, plus all the expert papers that go with them. This way of working on future systems is both described and legitimized by social science by concepts like hybrid forums, post-normal science of Ravetz and Fontovitz, and it has become a model that is transferred from one topic to the next. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment tries to replicate the compromise formulas that the IPCC panel has created. The idea here is that Academic forums work mostly on the modeling, the data that is behind it, that they also participate in hybrid forums, and that the rest is only a matter of political hypothesis or public participation if we're working on smaller scale ecological systems. What I am advocating through the book with my colleagues is that this model is not enough. Why? Because it rests on a huge imbalance between those aspects that are modeled, like rainfall or maybe tree growth, and those aspects that are not modeled, like social behavior, geopolitics, technical innovation of energy transformation technology, etc. There is no possibility of arguing that the modeled factors are more decisive than the others. And so the imbalance ought to be treated. Audrey Corot has shown in her review of literature in ecology that most authors write that modeling must be combined with scenarios and that it's no big problems because you can write scenarios in a few days. That's written in the publications. But if you have 200-year man of modeling combined with 15 days of scenario writing, you only have a 15 days worth of scenario and you have 100 years worth of modeling, and you cannot expect the combination to be a serious synergy between stories and simulation. So what we need is work whereby we try to build stories that are as elaborate, that are discussed as seriously as models are elaborated and discussed. For this reason, I think that all aspects of these future dynamics ought to be discussed seriously in academic arenas. And they also ought to be discussed in hybrid arenas. And of course, they are discussed in political forums. For instance, there is absolutely no good reason, I think, not to undertake serious work on the future social uses and perception of forests if we want to be able to couple forest models with forest management and use. There is no serious reason why we should not have strong academic work on possible future geopolitical situations if we want to be able to couple global change with the way it can impact on the human population and in the way it can be managed. So, to conclude, I'd like to say that the plea that I'm trying to make, as I said in my title, is first for revised theoretical underpinnings. Again, in the review she's done of the literature in ecology, Audrey has shown that there are really two trends. The first trend is those authors who say, okay, we are fragile here. Our discipline is able to model and thus to forecast only some dynamics. We should concentrate on those dynamics and become harder forecaster. This is Clark and Allies 2003. Other authors say, okay, we can model some aspects of ecological systems, but there are so many aspects that we cannot model and that are absolutely decisive for the future of those systems that we must rely on halfway solutions or hybrid system. This is, for instance, Carpenter. I think is that whatever size of the alternative you take, you do not hold a solution. If you focus on the forecastable, clearly you're going to leave away a massive amount of decisive aspects of the situation. And then the question is open, who is going to take those aspects over? And then there will have to be a mobilization of political scientists, historians, etc. It will not be enough to discuss that in workshops or scenarios that are marginal compared to the forecasting and modeling effort. And if we follow the way proposed by Carpenter and others to rely on the current mix of modeling and scenario methodologies, then we do not have much basis to strengthen seriously. I think, for instance, about the Georgia Basin exercise that's very often cited in Canada, I think. If we rely on this mixture without making explicit the theoretical underpinnings that they rest on, then we will muddle through, but we will not accomplish things at the scale where the challenge is. So in both cases, it's absolutely essential that we revise the theoretical underpinnings so that they will be able to support much more ambitious constructions, mixing more ambitious stories and more ambitious models. I have no concern that models are going to continue being more and more ambitious, so I'm pleading for the story part to become seriously treated academically. New disciplines are going to be needed there. Again, in the book, I wrote one chapter that asked the following question. In this conference, we heard statisticians or applied mathematicians commenting in details on fine points of how you do models and statistics, etc. It's very striking that everyone relies for the socio-political aspects on scenario methodologies, and I have not read yet one serious work in literary studies or narrative studies. There are entire disciplines out there that work on the structure of narrative, the impact of narrative, how narratives get communicated and transform themselves. None of that incredible academic potential has yet been used on narratives such as the IPCC scenarios or the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment scenarios. And this is, to me, it's astounding, because on these scenarios that have been drafted on the corner of an envelope almost rests all the meaning, the conclusions, and much of the input data of your models. And I think they would be worth tens or hundreds of years of work of specialists of narration, communication of narration, structure of narration, historians who have been working for 200 years on the relationship between data and narration. So new disciplines have to be brought in if we want to take up that challenge. Also, it will be necessary to take initiatives that come more from academia and that are less directly or systematically dependent on decision makers or political command. Why? Because if you're launching one of these large futures exercises, again, it's the same examples, and if you are launching them at the initiative of a UN organization, which is the case with most of them, then you are limited by those things that are acceptable to consider and publicly discuss within a UN framework. And there are many aspects of geopolitics, of social dynamics, etc., etc., that cannot be discussed in a UN-based forum, but that are of utmost importance for serious academic study of social or socio-ecological dynamics. So I'm also pleading for that we should drop a condition where we currently say we are ready to work on futures, not because it's academically serious, but because it is demanded by decision makers, to a condition where we're going to say we have resources in academia, we can solve the difficulties and the problems that are currently hindering our investing on studying futures. And academia can invest of its own accord and initiative in academic studies or scholarly studies of future situations and systems. The last slide will be for a few comments on the differences between future events and extreme events in the methodological and theoretical challenges that they raise. There are many common points. Most of the things I've said will bear both on extreme events and on slower, more gradual social and ecological evolutions. But the differences are such that, for example, in the 1980s, IASA has been trying to transfer military methodology for preparedness to extreme events into methodology to prepare for climate change impact and global climate impact. I worked for a few years with colleagues on that, and it did not work. And I think that this has interesting lessons. Extreme events, if they are not very long, justify a state of exception that is organizationally simple and that can be largely pre-organized. When George Bush, the father of the current president, was confronted with the first Gulf situation with Saddam Hussein invading Iraq, it took him 3 days to choose the military strategy. People came to him with strategy A, B, C, and maybe D. And it took them only two or three days to choose. And on the next day, the deployment of 500,000 soldiers over Arabia started. This means that military planning had studied in depth what is clearly an extreme situation. And they had studied dozens of possible configuration in all aspects of it, geopolitical, technical, military, etc., etc. So this kind of methodology is much easier to transfer for extreme events like earthquakes or huge climatic events than they are for gradual transformation of society. So I wanted to finish on that, to say that the two problems do not reduce one to the other. They share many characteristics. They are bound together because if there is a major climatic event in 2070, it will take place in the society and economy of 2070. But they still pertain to slightly different arenas of study. Thanks for your attention.
C'était Laurent Mermet, professeur à l'École nationale du génie rural, des eaux et des forêts, spécialisé dans l'analyse stratégique de la gestion environnementale. Il s'exprimait sur l'étude des situations environnementales encore non existantes pour des gestionnaires à venir. Cette cinquième et dernière retransmission du colloque de l'Académie des sciences, écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes enregistrée en juillet 2007 se termine ici. Poursuivez l'écoute des quatre précédentes retransmissions en les téléchargeant librement dans notre médiathèque. Elles sont consacrées aux rapports entre événements climatiques extrêmes et évolution des espèces, ainsi qu'aux réponses des systèmes écologiques. Merci de nous avoir suivis et à bientôt pour de nouvelles émissions. Thank you.